Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. More officers, more active shooter drills, more hardening of campuses. That is the reality facing school students in Charlotte and around the country. These efforts to improve security have become necessary because of a string of tragic events, and they are something being demanded by the students themselves. But there is a downside. These measures are taking an emotional and psychological toll on some young people. That was illustrated during a November lockdown at Charlotte's Governor's Village STEM Academy, where a student, hunkered on the floor, wrote a farewell letter to his mom. These drills and lockdowns, the wanding of students upon entry, random searches, are part of a new normal at schools. The Washington Post reported in December that last year, more than 4 million children took part in at least one lockdown at schools nationwide, and these lockdowns are causing lasting problems like depression. Charlotte is the site of the 14th annual Youth Violence Prevention Conference starting this Friday. In advance of that, we have three of the participants with us to talk about striking a balance between protecting and preparing students while acknowledging the impact these measures may be having on them. Dr. Samantha Haviland is Director of Counseling for the Denver, Colorado Public Schools. As a side note, she was a student at Columbine High School during the 1999 shooting there, and she joins us from the studios of KUVO in Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Robin Gerwich is a professor in psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University School of Medicine. She joins us from Durham. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Jean Deisinger is the former deputy chief of police and director of threat assessment services at Virginia Tech. He led that school's security assessment after the 2007 massacre and is now president of Deisinger Consulting. He joins us via Skype. Thank you for being here, too.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Dr. Gerwich, let me begin with you. School systems have adopted these several safety measures since Columbine in the aftermath of Sandy Hook following Parkland, which seemed to have the most traumatic impact on students. Or is it the collective experience of the news and the drills and the lockdowns that is having the emotional impact?
I think you summed it up. We're in a new era, and these are part of students' new life when they go to school. So I think it is all of those things. I think it's the drills. I think it's the preparedness. I think it's the news and the actions. So as we look, we know that there are children that are going to be more affected by these new experiences and this new normal, and there'll be things that we can do to begin to help them be better prepared. And not only just the students, but we have to recognize that adults are part of this system too, whether it's parents or other caregivers, school personnel, everybody is part of this. So we need to make sure that we're addressing the needs of everybody affiliated with the school system.
How are these drills different, these lockdowns different, psychologically speaking, from what those of us who went to school in the 50s and 60s experienced when we had nuclear attack drills and got under the desks and went into the hallways and covered our heads? How is it different? Because Everybody was talking then about we could be annihilated in a nanosecond.
So I will tell you that we can't know for sure whether all that the children that were under their desks, like the desk was going to protect us from those weapons, really were not affected, because for many, many years, in fact, it hasn't been until the 80s that we began to ask children themselves, how are they doing? So we really don't know that there may not have been children that were truly terrified about going to school and about those drills. So it's not that, gosh, back then nobody worried as much as they do now. We just never asked the questions of them before. And we're doing a much better job being able to appreciate and talk with students families and staff about how do these drills affect them.
Dr. Havel,
what we've learned is that if we can be prepared, we can really reduce some of those heightened anxieties.
Okay. Dr. Haviland, how much of the difference may be the fact that when we practice these nuclear drills, it was an evil foreign power that might be unleashing this. But these drills, today's drills, are to protect students from people they might know. How much of that plays a role in fear?
I mean, yeah, it is a real challenge for our students in our school district right now. Our students they've witnessed it at a higher rate. So when our students in the Parkland filmed, for example, and that hit social media, my students got to witness that. So it's very, very real to them. And it's a monthly drill also. So the students are locking the doors, sitting in the dark, sitting on the floor away from any windows once a month. And they're starting at the age of six. So I'm a little too young to have witnessed those drills myself from the nuclear attacks, but it's very real for our students.
In Charlotte, and I'm sure it's similar around the country, we have guns being brought into the schools, including elementary schools, by students. We're fortunate here to have had only one incident in which a gun was fired on campus, though it was a fatal incident. So which is worse for these students, the drills and precautions, or the fact that they know that their fellow students might be carrying a firearm in their backpack? Gene Dysinger, let me throw that at you.
Well, I don't know that we can make a universal distinction about which is better or worse for a given individual. I think that varies tremendously by community. I think the other thing that often gets lost, while there are some real challenges in balancing preparedness and security, we need to not forget that another part of this stool is the well-being of the members of the school. And a focus only on response capabilities like lockdown and the drills, while those things are important, they're not sufficient really for building the safety and the well-being overall. I would argue too that another change, and I went through those drills, the nuclear drills back in the late 60s, early 70s, and another real difference here is that when law enforcement is involved in the drills is that you've got people coming into the room as posing as active threats. And then it's much more realistic than being instructed by a teacher to sit under your desk in case there's a bright flash. So I think we've got to think through, what are the ramifications? What are we teaching? What are the benefits? And what are the costs as we move forward?
And Anne emails a very apropos comment. She says she's not sure about my analogy. She said no children were killed as a result of nuclear bombs. Many children have been killed by school shooters. This is a much more real threat to today's kids. That's absolutely true, beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's been 20 years, Dr. Haviland, since the shooting at your alma mater, Columbine High School. Those shootings shocked the nation. We've been shocked time and time again by these school shootings. There have been more than 225 shootings at U.S. primary and secondary schools since your school was attacked by two of its own. What happened at Columbine in the days, weeks, and months that followed that incident and the years that followed there and around the country? What happened to increase security there?
To increase security at Columbine? Or
mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So shortly after, we obviously were not able to return to our school building. It was the scene of a major crime and was pretty destroyed. We had returned to a rival high school, and in that we had FBI agents that were checking IDs for anybody who entered the building, students included, and also had bomb sweeps and locked doors and all kinds of stuff. And then the following year was pretty similar. You had to wear your ID, which is actually common practice in a lot of schools right now, which I'm supportive of, making sure that people who are in the building are supposed to be in the building. However, I recognize that that would not have prevented the shooting at Columbine or many of these other school shootings that have happened. So currently, practice would be to check IDs, and a lot of school districts have put into place ID scanners to make sure not only do we know who's in the building, we also know if they've had any prior concerns.
You're the only person on this panel, and possibly one of the only people listening, hopefully one of the only people listening, who's actually been through one of these horrific events.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about what happened that day or how you felt that day, but I am curious about how you dealt with it in the moment and how you and your fellow students have dealt with it since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the moment, honestly, I experienced so much shock. I didn't understand what was happening. When we talk about traumatic response, and it's the fight or flight that are so common, there's a third reaction there called freeze. And that's ultimately what my response was the day of. I just didn't believe it. I sat kind of in awe and was lucky to escape because of friends that pulled me through. Later that night, I still didn't believe it. I didn't understand if I would have school the next day. You know, we had never seen anything like it, so it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And then in the years after, I traveled and I spoke to other students to try to prevent other school shootings, and I think that was a major part of my own coping. And then 10 years later, as a practicing school counselor, I recognized my own need for mental health. I had some markers of post-traumatic stress disorder and went and sought some therapy for that. A lot of my peers are still struggling with their post-traumatic stress disorder, and I see that out of staff members as well as and every shooting, and not just school shooting, but every mass shooting, the Las Vegas shooting, for example, has caused a lot of fear in my peers, where some of them struggle to go to the grocery store every day, just knowing that our communities are not safe.
Mm. Jean Dysinger, you were brought in to Virginia Tech following the shooting there in 2007 to assess campus security and increase security on this campus. You also have a psychology degree. You're a founding member of the Iowa State University Critical Incident Response Team. How do all of these areas of expertise come together for you to help you assess just how safe a school is or is not?
Well, being trained as a psychologist and as a law enforcement officer, I found as a great benefit for serving the community that I was blessed to be part of in the aftermath of the horrible incident of April 16th, 2007. My duties were split between managing day-to-day operations for the police department, but with also focusing on developing and enhancing the behavioral threat assessment and management processes that were recommended in the aftermath of the 2007 incident, as they had been following Columbine, as they have been since following Parkland, et cetera. And so it's working and engaging with the community to foster a sense of engagement, to identify developing concerns, to assess those in meaningful ways, and to develop case management strategies to help the community, again, to support that safety and well-being. I was blessed to work with a very proactive police department that was highly engaged with the community, that had earned the trust of that community. And I've learned that all of those things are essential. And not every community is blessed with that relationship, and it's something we all need to work on.
Mm-hmm. These shootings are happening all the time now. There are too many guns in the world and too many people willing to use them to solve problems. We're actually doing a whole program on this tomorrow locally because our murder rate is sky high at the moment in Charlotte. And it's because of guns and because of people who know other people shooting their friends and neighbors. But when we come back, I want to ask you, Gene, how safe we can actually be and how safe our schools are in comparison to other public places where we might go on any given day. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of lockdowns and school shooter safety drills at schools here and around the country on the students who have to participate in these drills for their own safety. And we're talking about this with Dr. Samantha Haviland, Director of Counseling Services in the Denver, Colorado Public Schools. Dr. Robin Gerwich is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. And Gene Deisinger is the president of Deisinger Consulting. He was brought in the aftermath of the shooting at Virginia Tech to assess that school and improve that school's security measures. As we talk right now, there is a school in Batavia, Illinois, outside Chicago, on lockdown because of a report of a man with a rifle entering the school. Police, I'm told, have not found anything to substantiate that report, but kids are being sent home. Before the break, I was going to ask you, Gene, how safe we can really be. Can any place be 100% safe? But more importantly, how would you assess the safety in schools versus the safety in places like shopping malls and amusement parks or on city sidewalks, for that matter? Are we safe?
Well, there's no good answer to that that's going to satisfy everybody. And certainly, over time, there are ebbs and flows in violent crime. It varies from community. I understand Charlotte is dealing with an uptick of that more recently. If we step back and look at larger patterns, homicide rates in the United States are at the lowest that they've been since the late 1950s, early 1960s, well below where they were in the 70s through the early 80s. If we look at the active threat or mass casualty incidents over about the last 15 to 18 years, we see that about a quarter or a little less have occurred in educational settings, about 15-16% in K through 12 schools, and the rest in higher education. The larger risk for active shooter events is in public commercial venues. That said, active shooter mass casualty incidents account for about 1 to 1.5% of all homicides that occur in the United States. And I'm not saying that to minimize anything. There is an issue here because there is an uptick, it appears, in the base rate of mass casualty incidents over the last 20 years that flies in the face of the overall downturn in violent crime over that same time frame. So we do have a troubling dynamic that has occurred, but I don't buy into that there's epidemic proportions of this at this point. I think our precautions need to be reasonable, but I also think they need to be proportional to the real risks.
Are we overreacting?
I think in some communities at some times, yes. I think that's a pretty natural human response. While these events are not frequent, they're catastrophic when they do occur. And I think that's what our minds go to. So that's a pretty natural human reaction. I do think we have to temper that with the realities that in schools on a day-to-day basis, the greater threat is not a mass casualty incident. It's the child that lives so in fear of family violence that they're not able to focus at school. They're bullied, they're harassed, so there's a source of bias and bigotry that undermines their self-confidence and their self-efficacy, their health and well-being. Members of the school staff are victims of domestic violence and come into work. And there's child custody disputes in the parking lot before and after school. These are all real day-to-day issues that have just as detrimental impact on a school and on a community when they occur.
Not everybody who is over a certain age has been through a lockdown. Not everybody who, even with kids, understands what happens sometimes during a lockdown. Dr. Gerwich, I'm sure it's different from school to school, school district to school district, but what does happen during a lockdown?
Well, I think one thing I can, if I could, I'm going to piggyback on the answer you just received, because I think, you know, here we are in April, which is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and I do want to underscore that those issues are so much more prevalent and do have an impact on students' emotional health, which is a much larger problem. If we think about lockdowns, I think we have to recognize also the difference between probability and possibility so that we don't completely stop living our lives. To your question that you just asked about what happens, I will say that they do vary based on the school's needs and the grade levels, the developmental issues of the students. I think most importantly, everybody needs to be aware that they are going to happen. Surprise drills are not good for anybody. And so making sure as schools plan their drills to notify parents and families to let students know this is a drill. Because if you don't, you can end up with many more children and families and staff that can experience some pretty significant distress and trauma reactions, particularly if they've experienced any type of trauma in their past. But they may be everything from a walkthrough to a tabletop exercise to a live drill. And so schools really do vary how they implement those drills, but there needs to be massive communication around what's happening.
But if you're in the middle of, whether it's a drill and you know about it, or it's a surprise drill and you don't know about it, or it's the real thing, what physically is happening? What are students told to do? What are teachers told to do?
So again, that will vary based on the circumstances. So in depending on what is actually happening, if it's real, they may be told, and I'm sure the expert in security has a much more a better answer than what I'm going to give you. But I think as we think about it, students may be told to either hide. They may be told, depending on the situation, to run, to get out. So there are different scenarios that children are expected to engage in when there is a drill.
So Jean Dysinger, help me out there with that, because the thinking about what to do in these situations has evolved over time.
Well, it has, and a recognition that there is no one answer that was going to fit for every situation. And the outline just given summarizes the dynamic choices that individuals are faced with when confronted by an active threat, whether that's someone with an edged weapon or a firearm that's actively trying to harm. We advise people to consider what their options are. If you can get away, get away. If you've not yet been detected and you can put a barricade and a locked door, ideally, between you and the threat, what we find is that in most of the active threat situations, they're rapidly evolving, and the suspect or the perpetrator, if they confront an obstacle, will move to an easier venue, an easier target, which is a horrific way to think of it, but it's the reality of the situation.
Are there best practices that school systems are being encouraged to adopt?
Well, the dynamic decision-making, I'm getting away from the ordered sequence of run, then if that doesn't work, hide, and if that doesn't work, then fight. I hope that we've moved beyond that universally because, again, as I think it was Dr. Gerwich and was indicating, each of these situations is different. And teachers and staff and students, as developmentally appropriate, need to consider what circumstance or what option is best for what circumstance. And by the way, that's really no different than in fire drills and considering what you can do. Get out if you can, put a protective barrier if you can't easily get out, and fight for your life if you have to. Fight the fire, fight through the fire, et cetera. It's really a very similar choice making, and there's no one right answer for all situations.
And Dr. Haviland, there seems to be, because I read about this yesterday, there seems to be two schools of thought on whether or not, if you're going to conduct these drills, whether the people involved participating in them should know whether they're a drill or the real thing. What's your take on that?
So I totally respect and understand the notifying students, and absolutely we are causing some trauma by doing the drills in the first place. We, in practice, don't notify our students because we want them to be prepared if we don't notify them and it turns into a real situation. We don't want that to be an unpracticed kind of a thing. And I've been processing what some of my counterparts have been talking about. You know, the thing is that mass shootings, while they are rare, they're very real to our students right now because of the social media aspects of modern day culture. Our students are witnessing this when they could be miles and miles, hundreds of miles away from any situation. They are seeing it through Instagram and YouTube and all kinds of things. And it reminds me, there was a student out of the Santa Fe shooting who said that she knew it was going to happen to her. She just didn't know when. And while we've practiced for fire, you know, like fire drills, for example, were always a thing when I was in school. It was never real to me because I had never really been in a fire, and it was just kind of something that we participated in. But these drills are very, very real for our student. They are causing some trauma, but the schools are doing everything that they can. And in Denver Public Schools, what our lockdowns look like, usually there's lockouts and there's lockdowns, and we practice both once a month. Lockouts are that there's someone outside of the school, and so no one can enter or leave, but school looks the same. And then lockdowns, and I, as a professional, have to participate in these because my office is located in a school. We lock the doors, turn off the lights, and have to be out of sight from any window or door, which means I'm a 36-year-old professional, you know, in my dress and high heels, underneath my desk, looking at my own employees who are the same.
And if you don't know whether this is a drill or the real thing, it seems to me that that would cause more trauma than it simply being told at 11:15 this morning we're going to have this drill. You know, right. It's not real.
Right.
Yeah, but I understand the reasoning for not telling kids, because you want them to take this seriously. You don't want them to be joking around and not paying attention. But how do you minimize the potential scarring of students when you don't tell them whether it's real or not?
It varies by age level. I think one of my counterparts mentioned that too. You know, with the littles, the 6 and 7 year olds that we're doing this, we work on trying to minimize it through yoga positions and meditation. And obviously there's a lot of processing that has to happen with students at all ages. But yeah, bottom line is it's a scary time to be a school-age student right now.
So I was reading an article yesterday from, I'm not sure where it came, the Boston Globe. And the reporter was in a classroom, and on the classroom wall was a piece of poster board with lyrics on it for these lockdowns to the tune of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Lockdown, lockdown, lock the door, shut the lights off, say no more, go behind the desk and hide, wait until it's safe inside, lockdown, lockdown, it's all done, now it's time to have some fun. Mm. That strikes me, and it struck this reporter, as being horrific in and of itself, that you would have that in a first grade or second grade classroom. So Dr. Gerwich, since these happen at all levels of education, these drills, who has the more psychologically difficult time with it? Is it the younger students who may or may not be fully aware of why this is going on or why we have a need for this, or the older students who are very clearly aware of why this is going on?
Yes, there are different levels of risk depending on the age, and I think that idea of the Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, what you find in most classrooms is that they do have information about what to do, so that children do know. The reactions are going to vary, and I totally agree with my counterpart in Denver. This children do know, they recognize it, they see it, social media, news coverage, it is quite there. But we also want to make sure that children are not immobilized, so that children know that school, by and large, can be a safe place. They don't need to stay at home and hunker down and bar the windows and doors, because if they walk outside, something terrible may happen. And so when we think about who is going to be most impacted, we have different types of reactions depending on the age. Young children may not truly appreciate or understand, but then they have a different level of fear and worry, because if they are exposed to it, for example, on TV, instant replay is not something they completely understand. So you would think that there are schools being shot every single minute of the day because of the replays, whereas older children do understand that, and students in high school, though, recognize that the majority of these shootings do happen in middle, if not high school. So there are those differences. The good news is that we have incredibly effective ways to help students that may be struggling. We've come a long, long way in the last 20 years in terms of our ability to help children and adults that may be struggling with PTSD or other types of reactions. So we can be more cognizant, more aware of the signs that children may have, that adults may have, that they are struggling. I respect, but I do know that when children, when you practice drills and you don't know that they're coming, you also may have some unintended effects that it becomes, wow, this is just another pretend drill, and so I don't take it seriously when it actually happens, because we've gone through so many that it wasn't, and I can't recognize if children, particularly teens, are running out the side doors and I can't account for them. Children with disabilities, children that may have emotional challenges that are not prepared, the risk for traumatic impact goes through the roof, particularly if I've been through another trauma and I don't appreciate that this is something that is working toward my safety. And so if it is not a drill, I know that this is the real thing, because in the past I've been told this is a drill, this is now happening and it's not a drill. There are balances you have to take on which side do you want more distress happening, more children having pretty significant reactions, and how do we make sure that in advance we can identify the children that we know are at higher risk for psychological problems, for psychological impact because of these situations and because of these drills. We know who to look for. We may miss some, but at least we're going to get the majority that are going to be at higher risk.
Dr. Robin Gurwitch is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Duke University School of Medicine. She's joining us from Durham. Dr. Samantha Haviland joins us from the Denver Public Schools in Colorado, where she is the director of counseling services. And Gene Deisinger is former deputy chief of police for Virginia Tech and the president of Deisinger Consulting. We're talking about school safety and lockdowns and the psychological impact of those things, and we will continue in just a moment. Lake Norman area towns, Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson, have experienced exponential growth in the last two decades. As a result, the area has faced challenges with development, transportation, and maintaining vibrant downtowns as leaders and planners work to keep up with the rising number of residents. Join me for a special public conversation on growing pains in Lake Norman Thursday, April 18th at CPCC's Marenkas campus in Huntersville at 7 p.m. For details and registration, go to WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about school safety, lockdowns, and the psychological impact of these drills that students have to go through all over the country now because of tragic events at various schools around the country. Dr. Samantha Haviland is with the Denver Public Schools, Director of Counseling Services. They're the Denver, Colorado, I should say, not North Carolina. Dr. Robin Gurwitch, Professor of Psychiatry at the Duke University School of Medicine, and Gene Deisinger, the President of Deisinger Consulting. Let me ask the million-dollar question of you, Gene. Is there any agreement on how effective these drills are?
No, there's not, because there's so much diversity in how they're done. And I think we need to look not just at the effectiveness of the drills, but the effectiveness of the system that drills occur within. And I think it was both Dr. Gurwitch and Dr. Haviland spoke to the aftercare provided to the school when drills are done. I think many of our youth are remarkably resilient. My colleagues are right. These are very real issues for students and for staff as well. I think the effectiveness of the drill is just not is not measured only in did people do what we would want them to do, but did they build their sense of confidence and competence moving forward? And or have we undermined that? Have we created people who now feel so debilitated and afraid that they're less capable of surviving a critical incident?
Well, I was going to ask you if you think that we are causing more problems than we're solving with these drills.
I think in individual situations, we've seen outcomes that would lead a reasonable person to believe that we may have. Again, I'm not comfortable giving a universal because there's tremendous variety in how drills are done, how realistic do they need to be to really be helpful. Can we do walkthroughs of issues and be just as effective of a very realistic drill where people have mock injuries and such? I'm not sure how much those examples are value added to helping people consider how to survive a threatening incident.
Well, Dr.
I don't think we really know.
Dr. Haviland, you've been through as a student one of these incidents because you were a student at Columbine when that incident took place. And now you're in the Denver, Colorado Public Schools as a counselor, as a director of counseling services. So let me ask you, if gun violence in schools is rare, but the lockdowns and precautions are taking place regularly, sometimes week by week in these school systems, and causing damage to student psychological health, is all of this worth it?
I would say yes, because as a school system, our number one effort is to keep our students safe. And if practicing a drill over and over again gives us even the slightest chance of student survival in the chance that a shooter enters our school, then it's worth it, right? The challenge is how do we help our students and our families to process what it is that we're asking them to do? How do we help them process that schools are no longer necessarily a super safe environment? Which, you know, a big part of this is also that our communities are not safe. Our schools are working very, very hard at keeping our students safe. But we've seen now that this is a thing outside of our schools as well. So how do we help individuals just process that
a
bottom line?
We've been talking about the damage, the psychological damage that is potentially being done to kids because of all of this. Let's be specific. What are they experiencing? What kinds of symptoms are they manifesting as a result of this around the country?
Mm-hmm. It'll vary. It can be as simple as lack of concentration and inability to focus on their academic needs, which is important. But there's also, an immediate response. We've had students that have been so scared that they do run and they, jump out of windows and things.
So I've been reading that this is causing depression in students and in younger people. It's that they're just sad, and that's depression. Mm-hmm. Worsening academic and social progression, anxiety, poor sleep, all the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, even substance abuse now or later in life as a result of this. And I guess, Dr. Gerwich, I'm curious as to how many of these symptoms are merely temporary because of the moment, and how many of these are liable to go through life with you?
That's a really good question. And it is, I wish I could give you an easy answer. I break my arm 6 to 8 weeks later, it comes out of the cast, and it's puny, but it's pretty good. Mental health is not quite that black and white. So what we do know is that for most kids, if they have some distress, it will start to diminish within about 4 weeks. If it continues, that may be an indication that it is causing more distress and some more attention needs to be paid to that with help from a professional, perhaps. But if any time a parent or caregiver is worried about changes in their child, don't wait. seek support, because like I said, we know, and if we can get in earlier, it is better. It's never too late, so that's the good news. But I think I would agree that attention, concentration, sleep problems, sort of intrusive thoughts, I think about this even when I'm trying hard not to.
Yeah.
So we know that there are things that can happen, but it should begin to diminish, particularly if we encourage our students, as was mentioned, you know, some yoga or meditation or some breathing activities if they are distressed. So that can help reduce some of those worries and concerns. But if it continues and begins to interfere with school, and it's not going away, interfering with our relationships with friends or family, and that's not beginning to go away, interfering with our ability to actually, you mentioned it, to enjoy life, not feel sad, to feel hopeful, that may be a sign. So there are many different levels, and we also have to take into account what a student's experience with any type of traumatic event may have been, or any kind of extreme stressor may have been in the past, because that can augment and make worse the distress experienced with the current situations and drills.
So, Dr. Haviland, you work within the school system as a counselor in Denver, Colorado. Should we be providing, are schools providing, and I know this varies from school to school, district to district, psychological counseling or some sort of help for students? Are they getting it? Are they being recognized, the need being recognized?
Not as often as it should be, I'll say that. The American School Counselor Association recommends a counselor-to-student ratio of 1 to 250. Some schools are doing that and following that, and some are not. And I have to say, more likely, the secondary schools are the ones that have the school counselors and have appropriate ratios for mental health to student. But our younger kids, our elementary, are less likely to have access to that.
You know, we're focused on what's happening as the result of these drills psychologically with children, but what about the kids who have to deal with things in their personal lives and who have trauma associated with that? Are they getting help? Is that being recognized? Is that leading, in some cases, to kids taking a gun and bringing it to school?
You know, we've seen an increase in suicidality across the nation among our adolescents. And one of the major markers when we do threat assessments is we measure that suicidality as well, because the likelihood that a student is suicidal when they're making threats is very high. So if we can remediate the suicidality, then we've pretty much terminated the threat or made good strides there. No, I don't think that we, as a country have done enough to address even just the things that are happening for students at home.
Steven Schultzman, who is a child psychiatrist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, calls the trauma resulting from these safety measures in schools a clear and pressing public health issue. Mm. Do the three of you agree with that? I'll start with Dr. Haviland. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that statement. Yeah.
Dr. Gerwich?
I do agree. We need to do a better job.
Gene Deisinger?
I do.
So would it be accurate to say that one public health issue, the increasing amount of gun violence and the deficiency in mental health services, is leading now to this other public health issue? Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. Gene, do we know if these drills have saved a single life?
I honestly don't know, Mike, how you measure that. I think anecdotally, we've got people, and I've had the privilege of working with survivors from critical incidents from around the country who said that the school's preparedness or the workplace's preparedness better helped them make choices that led to their survival or diminished the risk of injury. That's on an anecdotal basis. Are there others that were at no greater advantage, couldn't process what was happening, were caught in the freeze response, which is a very prototypical part of the dynamic as well? Sometimes, no matter how much training that you've had, we've seen police officers do it who go through markedly more training and more realistic training as a broad generalization.
Let me share some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Andrew emails, I was volunteering in an elementary school classroom in Rock Hill, which is just south of us, for those of you who don't live here. And a threat led police to lock down the school for about an hour. I was flabbergasted by the line of cars with parents picking up their kids due to this threat. How do we get parents my age, in my 30s, who came of age with school safety threats, not to overreact when it comes to their own kids? Jean, that's a good question for you, I would think. What do you tell parents? Because we had an incident here in Charlotte where there was a lockdown and parents almost impeded the access to the school of emergency professionals because they wanted to get their kids out.
Right. My experience has been you've got to engage with the parents and the community well before a critical incident or a response to a perceived critical incident, and outlining what the response is going to involve, that it's well prepared, it's well planned, it's well equipped, they're well trained, and we need access. We being law enforcement need access unimpeded to the scene, and that there will be a process and a way of reuniting students with their families as expeditiously and safely as possible. Those are not things that you can begin to communicate while a crisis is occurring. People are not prepared to hear that. It's just too late. So you've got to lay that out and build trust and confidence and engagement with parents and with your community well beforehand.
Dennis emails, at my wife's school, she's a teacher, when the shooter drill goes on, they lock the classroom door, line up against the wall so that they're not viewable from the doorway, and the teachers are instructed never to unlock the door. Only the police with keys can unlock them. Once the police forgot to unlock the door, and it was hours before they were discovered. Does that sound like a good process to you? Gene.
Well, obviously not. What was missing from there was a communications protocol within the plan and a way for people to reach out when there's been time periods, when there's no activity, and to get a status report. And again, we just focus on drills or just focus on the responses. We've got to take a broader view of what we're helping people to do.
Andrea on Twitter, the kids in Newtown had no drills, but some managed to survive anyway by escaping or hiding. Why are we traumatizing kids needlessly? Dr. Haviland.
Is it needlessly?
That's Beth. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. And I, you know, obviously we all have our own reaction in the event that someone threatens our lives, that we hope that, you know, we're looking out for our own survival. This is a school system's, an education system's attempt to keep our students safe from things that we can't control.
Would it be, I don't know how to ask this question, whether it, go ahead, Dr. Gerwig.
I totally agree that that we do need to be better prepared. Because I think if we miss this opportunity, that's going to be our mistake. And I totally agree with Dr. Haviland that this is school systems working really hard to keep students as safe as possible. But I also think we need to recognize that we don't sometimes get to pick who students go to if they're worried or if they know something or if they're having a struggle. It may not be the school counselor. It may be the history teacher or the math teacher or my homeroom teacher.
Well, is there enough time? Is there therapeutic value? And is there, we're very short on time, but is there therapeutic value and enough time in the school day to have some sort of non-educational but therapeutic talk it out session with students about what they're thinking and feeling?
What we do know, and you led me beautifully, thank you very much, what we do know is if we can help teachers be better prepared of how they can support students, and it doesn't necessarily have to be talk it out pro time in the classroom, but just how do we engage and interact and talk to kids during the school day doing what we normally do. but we've got to be better supportive of the of our school personnel so they can be better supportive across the board to students to maybe reduce those kids that feel marginalized or feel like there's no other alternative than violence or suicide or something else.
So I have 20 seconds, Dr. Haviland. Kids are calling for more precautions. Kids are saying we want to be safe in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. Is this what they're calling for? Is this what they're asking for, lockdowns?
I think they're asking for us to have a conversation among adults to solve the problem that mass shootings are an issue.
Dr. Samantha Haviland is the Director of Counseling Services at the Denver Public Schools in Colorado and a student at Columbine in 1999. Dr. Robin Gerwich, Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences at the Duke University Medical School, and Jean Deisinger, who is the President of Deisinger Consulting. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.